please, senor. Not me. Take her. Take my daughter. Jacob looked up at her, away from the child's feet, his mouth still open with laughter, and was struck by the terror in her eyes. His laugh creaking to a close, he shook his head, thinking, God help me, if this is not the most wretched business.
Welcome to a special edition of Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibing. This week, we're proud to devote four podcasts to Toni Morrison's new novel. It's called A Mercy, and it takes on the consequences of a complicated act. The year is 1682. A mother, a slave on a Maryland plantation, begs a stranger to take her little daughter away from her. We'll meet that stranger now in this first reading from the novel. Jacob Vark is Dutch-American, a tradesman journeying through the colonies. He has no idea what's about to be set in motion, or that he will help lay the foundations for a history that haunts us still. Novelist Toni Morrison has won the Nobel and the Pulitzer Prizes. Her reading from A Mercy will be followed by selections from an interview by NPR Books correspondent Lynn Neary.
The man moved through the surf, stepping carefully over pebbles and sand to shore. Fog, Atlantic and reeking of plant life, blanketed the bay and slowed him. He could see his boots sloshing, but not his satchel, nor his hands. When the surf was behind him and his soul sank in mud, he turned to wave to the sloop men. But because the mast had disappeared in the fog, he could not tell whether they remained anchored or risked sailing on, hugging the shore and approximating the location of wharves and docks. Unlike the English fogs he had known since he could walk, or those way north where he lived now, this one was sun-fired, turning the world into thick, hot gold. Penetrating it was like struggling through a dream. As mud became swamp grass, he turned left, stepping gingerly until he stumbled against wooden planks leading up beach toward the village. Other than his own breath and tread, the world was soundless. It was only after he reached the live oak trees that the fog wavered and split. He moved faster then, more in control, but missing, too, the blinding gold he had come through. Picking his way with growing confidence, he arrived in the ramshackle village, sleeping between two huge riverside plantations. There the hostler was persuaded to forego a deposit if the man signed a note, Jacob Vark. The saddle was poorly made, but the horse, Regina, was a fine one. Mounted, he felt better, and rode carefree and a little too fast along beach fronts until he entered an old Lenape trail. Here there was reason to be cautious, and he slowed Regina down. In this territory, he could not be sure of friend or foe. Half a dozen years ago, an army of blacks, natives, whites, mulattoes, freedmen, slaves, and indentured had waged war against local gentry, led by members of that very class. When that people's war lost its hopes to the hangman, the work it had done, which included the slaughter of opposing tribes and running the Carolinas off their land, spawned a thicket of new laws authorizing chaos in defense of order by eliminating manumission, gatherings, travel, and bearing arms for black people only, by granting license to any white to kill any black for any reason, by compensating owners for a slave's maiming or death. They separated and protected all whites from all others forever. Any social ease between gentry and laborers, forged before and during that rebellion, crumbled beneath a hammer wielded in the interest of the gentry's profits. In Jacob Vark's view, These were lawless laws, encouraging cruelty in exchange for common cause, if not common virtue. In short, 1682, and Virginia was still a mess. Who could keep up with the pitched battles for God, king, and land? Even with the relative safety of his skin, solitary traveling required prudence. He knew he might ride for hours with no company but geese flying over inland waterways. And suddenly, from behind felled trees, a starving deserter with a pistol might emerge. Or in a hollow, a family of runaways might cower. Or an armed felon might threaten. Carrying several kinds of specie and a single knife, he was a juicy target. Eager to be out of this colony, into a less precarious, but personally more repellent one, Jacob urged the mare to a faster pace. He dismounted twice, the second time to free the bloody hind leg of a young raccoon stuck in a tree break. Regina munched trailside grass while he tried to be as gentle as possible, avoiding the claws and teeth of the frightened animal. Once he succeeded, the raccoon limped off, perhaps to the mother, forced to abandon it, or more likely, into other claws. Galloping along, he was sweating so heavily his eyes salted and his hair matted on his shoulders. Already October, and Regina was drenched and snorting. No such thing as winter down here, he thought, and he might as well have been in Barbados, which he had considered once, although its heat was rumored to be more lethal than this. But that was years ago, and the decision was null before he could act on it. An uncle he had never met, from the side of his family that had abandoned him, died and left him 120 acres of a dormant patroonship in a climate he much preferred, one with four distinct seasons. Yet this mist, hot and rife with gnats, did not dampen his spirits. Despite the long sail in three vessels down three different bodies of water, and now the hard ride over the Lenape Trail, he took delight in the journey, breathing the air of a world so new, almost alarming in rawness and temptation, never failed to invigorate him. Once, beyond the warm gold of the bay, he saw forests untouched since Noah, shorelines beautiful enough to bring tears, wild food for the taking. The lies of the company about the easy profit awaiting all comers did not surprise or discourage him. In fact, it was hardship, adventure, that attracted him. His whole life had been a mix of confrontation, risk, and placating. Now here he was, a ratty orphan become landowner, making a place out of no place, a temperate living from raw life. He relished never knowing what lay in his path, who might approach with what intention. A quick thinker, he flushed with pleasure when a crisis, large or small, needed invention and fast action. Rocking in the poorly made saddle, he faced forward while his eyes swept the surroundings. He knew the landscape intimately from years ago, when it was still the old Swedish nation, and later, when he was an agent for the company. Still later, when the Dutch took control. During and after that contest, there had never been much point in knowing who claimed this or that terrain, this or another outpost, other than certain natives to whom it all belonged. From one year to another, any stretch might be claimed by a church, controlled by a company, or become the private property of a royal's gift to a son or a favorite. Since land claims were always fluid, except for notations on bills of sale, he paid scant attention to old or new names of towns or forts. Fort Orange, Cape Henry, New Amsterdam, Wiltwyck. In his own geography, he was moving from Algonquin to Susquehanna via Chesapeake on through Lenape, since turtles had a lifespan longer than towns. When he sailed the South River into the Chesapeake Bay, he disembarked, found a village, and negotiated native trails on horseback, mindful of their fields of maize, careful through their hunting grounds, politely asking permission to enter a small village here, a larger one there. He watered his horse at a particular stream and avoided threatening marshland fronting the pines. Recognizing the slope of certain hills, a copse of oak, an abandoned den, the sudden odor of pine sap, all of that was more than valuable. It was essential. In such ad hoc territory, Jacob simply knew that when he came out of that forest of pine, skirting the marshes, he was, at last, in Maryland, which, at the moment, belonged to the king entirely. Upon entering this privately owned country, his feelings fought one another to a draw. Unlike colonies up and down the coast, disputed, fought over, and regularly renamed, their trade limited to whatever nation was victor, the province of Maryland allowed trade to foreign markets. Good for planters, better for merchants, best for brokers. But the Palatinate was Romish to the core. Priests strode openly in its towns. Their temples menaced its squares. Their sinister missions cropped up at the edge of native villages. Law, courts, and trade were their exclusive domain, and overdressed women in raised heels rode in carts driven by 10-year-old Negroes. He was offended by the lax, flashy cunning of the Papists. Abhor that errant whore of Rome. The entire class in the children's quarter of the poorhouse had memorized those lines from their primer. And all her blasphemies, drink not of her cursed cup, obey not her decrees, which did not mean you could not do business with them. And he had outdealt them often enough, especially here, where tobacco and slaves were married, each currency clutching its partner's elbow. By sustained violence or sudden disease, either one was subject to collapse, inconveniencing everybody but the lender. Disdain, however difficult to cloak, must be put aside. His previous dealings with this estate had been with the owner's clerk while sitting on alehouse stools. Now, for some reason, he had been invited, summoned rather, to the planter's house, a plantation called Jublio. A trader asked to dine with a gentleman on a Sunday, so there must be trouble, he thought. Finally, swatting mosquitoes and on the watch for mud snakes that startled the horse, he glimpsed the wide iron gates of Jublio and guided Regina through them. He had heard how grand it was, but could not have been prepared for what lay before him. The house, honey-colored stone, was in truth more like a place where one held court. Far away to the right, beyond the iron fences enclosing the property and softened by mist, he saw rows of quarters, quiet, empty. In the fields, he reckoned, trying to limit the damage sopping weather had wrought on the crop. The comfortable smell of tobacco leaves, like fireplaces and good women serving ale, cloaked Jublio like balm. The path ended at a small brick plaza announcing a prideful entrance to a veranda. Jacob stopped. A boy appeared, and dismounting a bit stiffly, he handed over the reins, cautioning the boy. Water, no feed. Yes, sir, said the boy, and turned the horse around, murmuring, nice lady, as he led her away. Jacob Vark climbed 3 brick steps, then retraced them to stand back from the house and appraise it. 2 wide windows, at least 2 dozen panes in each, flanked the door. 5 more windows on a broad second story held sunlight glittering above the mist. He had never seen a house like it. The wealthiest men he knew built in wood, not brick, riven clapboards with no need for grand pillars, suitable for a house of parliament. Grandiose, he thought, but easy to build in that climate. Soft, southern wood, creamy stone, no caulking needed, everything designed for breeze, not freeze. Long hall, probably, parlors, chambers, easy work, easy living, but Lord, the heat. He removed his hat and wiped the sweat from his hairline with his sleeve. Then, fingering his soaking collar, he remounted the steps and tested the boot scraper. Before he could knock, the door was opened by a small, contradictory man, aged and ageless, deferential and mocking, white hair, black face. Afternoon, sir. Mr. Ortega is expecting me. Jacob surveyed the room over the old man's head. Yes, sir. Your hat, sir? Señor D'Ortega is expecting you. Thank you, sir. This way, sir.
This is NPR's Lynn Neary, and I'm here at the New York Public Library with the writer Toni Morrison to discuss her new book, A Mercy. It's a story that's set in colonial America, and through the distinct voices of her characters, she weaves a tapestry of life in the new world. So good to have you, and so good to talk with you this afternoon.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
In A Mercy, you return to the subject of slavery, but in a very different way,
yes,
and in a very different era. This is really the early times in America. Why did you choose to go to that era to tell this story?
I wanted to separate race from slavery, to see what it was like, what it might have been like to be a slave, but without being raced, where your status was being enslaved, but there was no application of racial inferiority. Because I couldn't believe that that was the natural state of people who were A-born and people who came here, that it had to be constructed, planted, institutionalized, and legalized. So I moved as far back as I was able when what we now call America was fluid, ad hoc, a place where countries from all over the world were grabbing at land and resources, and all sorts of people were coming here. So that time period, 1690, is 2 years before the Salem witch trials. Mm. So it seemed it was a very rich period for me.
And you have this tapestry of characters, and each of these characters seems to sort of represent a different aspect of life in America at that time, and a different kind of servitude and unpaid labor.
Oh, yes. One realizes that there was no civilization that did not rest on some form of enslavement, whether it was Athens or Moscow, or whether it was England or France. They called them different names, peons, serfs, what have you. But owning the labor of people was a constant in the world. So that was not the unusual thing. The unusual thing was coupling it with racism, which came much, much later. So for me, it was the ideal place to see how all of this began.
You have characters who are indentured servants. You have, of course, Florence, the young slave. Lena, a Native American woman who has no tribe any longer, and in many ways is the saddest character, I think, in the book. The wife of Jacob Vark, who is the master, who has no rights at all. It's a sort of stunning reminder, I think, as you're reading it, of how few people really had any power, really, in those
Indeed.
Days.
And that was both the danger as well as the salvation in this country, that somebody who had been a little ratty orphan could end up in this country and build a large and wonderful house, that a young Native American girl whose whole family and tribe had been wiped out by smallpox, as happened so much during that time, could come through, live with a family, be purchased, and have this sense of dedication and honor and reliability and loyalty. And that a young girl who had been really, as she puts it, thrown away and needy and so eager for love could emerge as an adult. Or the indentured servants, you know, learning that indentured servants appeared in wills, their contracts were bought, their children had to fulfill contracts. They were sometimes given relief legally. But between indentured servants and slaves, there was almost no difference except one, which is that the indentured servants were white and they could run away and not be discovered as quickly as if you were a slave and your skin color could identify you so quickly.
Let me ask you about Jacob Vark, that character. At the beginning of the book, when you first introduce him and during that journey that he takes, at a certain point you mention what the atmosphere is like in the country at that time, and you talk about a people's war, and the result of that people's war is that laws were created which separated white people forever, I think you put it, from everybody else. And I don't know anything about that. Tell me what's
interesting. Well, I had always heard about, it's called Bacon's Rebellion, and it was a group of men led by a landed gentry person, aristocrat, who gathered together white indentured servants, black slaves, other landed gentry, about 400 or 500 of them, in order to overthrow the governor in Virginia. But at any rate, that was this interesting mix of slave, free, indentured, and wealthy, who seemed to have the same purpose. And they were successful in the overthrow. And of course, the governor came back from England, they were all caught and hanged, etc. But the consequence of that, of a group that was not defined by race, status or class attacking the powers that be was so horrible that they rewrote several laws and added some. But for me, the pertinent ones were any white could maim or kill any black for any reason and not be prosecuted. And that was the classic split, because even if your interests as servants or indentured people or just poor farmers were the same as the Africans or the African Americans, you would not join with them because you had this little perk, which was whiteness, which is a construction in order to divide particularly poor people. And it has operated pretty much throughout the history of the country, where people with the same economic interests are divided because of the friction that has been laid down. And the people who benefit are the people who own everything.
And that's the moment when it happened in this country, you think?
That's a moment.
A moment.
And that's very early. That's 1673, before he's even there in Virginia. And that kind of thing spread because it was profitable and useful, and it protected landed gentry because they could divide and conquer.
Tomorrow, we'll continue with the next installment of Immersing. To hear this and to see a video of Lynn's interview with novelist Toni Morrison, visit npr.org/booktour.